This is the first day of this April 2017 seven-day session. And we'll go back to one of my favorite sources, Zen Master Basui. The book is called Mud and Water, which is a collection of talks by the Japanese Zen Master Basui, 14th century Japanese Zen Master. First, some biographical material about Basui. He's born in 1327. He's born during a period when the certain military family that had virtually ruled over Japan for more than 100 years was losing its control over the country, and Japan was on the verge of a civil war that would last more than 50 years. Now, Basui's mother had a dream that she would give birth to a demon child, so she was unable to shake off this fear, so she abandoned the newborn Basui in a nearby field. A family servant found the child there, took him in, and raised him. There's a footnote here that said that she may have just done so in a kind of a formal way, having clued in the family servant that where she would leave the baby so that the servant could rescue Basui. Roshi Kaplan always used to point out that in Japan, everything has a front and a back. There's the official front version of things, and then there's what's really going on in the back. It's very hard for us as Americans to appreciate this cultural difference, but there is this split. I remember once when my first time in Japan, I visited one rigorous Rinzai training dojo where they said that they got up at 3 a.m. and sat for 6 hours or something like that. And we came back and breathlessly reported this to Roshi Kaplan. He said, "Ah, they don't get up at 3 a.m. and there's the official version, and then there's the reality. And but what's curious is that the mother would have thought that just doing it officially, after having arranged for Basui, the baby, to be picked up, that doing it officially would be enough to avoid the curse of this so-called demon child. When he was four years old, Basui's father died. And then 3 years later, there was a memorial service for his father. In Japan, they would do a series of memorial services spread out over years. And at the three-year mark, at the three-year memorial service, young Basui asked the priest how his father could eat the offerings placed on the altar. This is a question that often comes up at introductory workshops, where someone who has the courage to ask it will say, why is the fruit and flower, what are they doing there on the altar? And if I have enough time left in the workshop, I'll explain that these are just concrete ways of expressing reverence for the Buddha, the Buddha's teaching, and above all for our own Buddha nature. It's a way of conveying respect, gratitude, reverence for our own Buddha nature, but in a concrete way, physical way, not just thinking it, or imagining it, this reverence, but playing it out, doing it physically through beautiful things like flowers and arrangement of fruit. But Basui asked how his father could eat these offerings. There's probably also cakes and maybe bread or rice. And then he was told by this loser priest that his father's soul would eat the offerings. And, you know, there is no such thing in Buddhist teaching or experience. And Basui then said, well, what is this thing you call a soul? And this triggered an inquiry, a great doubt mass that Basui would work through, spend most of his life working with. What is this thing called a soul? It takes a different form. It would take a different form a little bit later. When he was 9 years old, he was horrified by talk of the agonies of the three evil paths. The three evil paths are the lowest three realms of the six realms of unenlightened existence. So those lowest three are hell, the realm of hell, the realm of hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits, and the realm of animals. And then this brought him back to this question about the meaning of soul. I gotta actually say that the translation of the word soul, I mean, the word soul as a translation may not be entirely correct. Maybe it was in another translation would be essence or fundamental nature, because that's really what it comes down to, came down to for Basui, is what is the very essence of our nature. But the translator renders it as soul, and maybe that's a good translation. And then after some more years, this questioning about the meaning of soul led him to a more maybe sophisticated question, is who is the one who sees and hears and understands? This is the practice of a number of people here at the Sesshin. Who am I, or what am I? What is it that hears? What is it that feels pain? What is it that is tired? What is it that thinks? In other words, questioning the very fundamental nature of the subject, the one who is experiencing or perceiving. For long periods of time, he sat in zazen, forgetting his own body, until one day he realized there was nothing one could grasp to call the soul. So it was a kind of a realization of the emptiness of this world of phenomena. And the translator here, I'm reading from his introduction, Arthur Braverman, gives some credit to this guy who slaved probably for years in translating this difficult text. And then Braverman says, with this new view of the emptiness of all things, Basui no longer felt the burden of body and mind, and his doubts about the Buddha Dharma for the time being were cleared up. And this period of tranquility continued until one day he read in a popular book, "The mind is host, the body is guest." This is an old way of dividing reality, is host and guest. Host, of course, being that which is beyond change, and guest is the other. Once more, doubts began to arise in Basui. If the mind is host, he thought, then all cannot be void or empty. He's making the mistake of thinking that the host is somehow not empty, he was making the mistake of seeing, because the word host is there, he got caught in the word and came to think that it was some substance. And there's no such thing. Then it's just a synonym for soul. And he reasoned, this host must be the master who sees, hears, and understands that all things are empty. But then who is this master? And so his doubt, he had reached a deeper level of questioning. Now at the age of 20, he went to train under the Zen master Oko in his home province. He did not shave his head and become a monk, however, until he was 29. When he did at last officially become a monk, he had little taste for ritual and rejected the superstitions that clothed so many of the religious institutions of his time. He neither wore robes nor recited sutras like other monks. He simply practiced Zazen in an uncompromising fashion, oblivious to wind, rain, and cold. And this was to be his way throughout his life as a Zen practitioner. We'll hear later that he overcomes this resistance to ritual and to robes and reciting sutras. When his practice matured further, and he ran into a monk who he struck up a friendship with, monk from his hometown by the name of Tokuke, and this young monk had cut himself off from the world. He had retired to the mountains and had been practicing religious austerities for many years. When Basui heard of him, he decided to pay him a visit. And when Tokuke, seeing Basui with his head shaved but in layman's clothes, he asked suspiciously, "Why don't you wear monk's robes?" Basui, "I became a monk to understand the great matter of life and death, not to wear Buddhist robes." Tokuke, "I see. Then are you looking into the koans of the old masters?" Basui, "Of course not. How can I appreciate the words of others when I don't even know my own mind?" Tokuke, "Well then, how do you approach your religious practice?" Basui, "Having become a monk, I want to clarify the source of the great Dharma handed down by the Buddhas and the patriarchs. After attaining enlightenment, I want to save the bright and the dull, teaching each one according to his capacity. My true desire is to relieve others of their pain, even though I myself may fall into hell." So this is a real, genuine expression of the bodhisattva impulse, putting others before oneself. Very, very auspicious sign. And Tokuke recognized this, and he placed his palms together and bowed, and a friendship developed between these two. Basui vowed not to preach a word of the Dharma to others until he received certification of his own realization from a true teacher. Once he received such certification, he would devote his life to helping others. To fulfill this vow, he practiced harder than ever, telling himself this doubting mind, that is, this questioning mind, is after all empty. He carried this investigation as far as he could without any real clarification. Until, one day, after sitting in Zazen through the night, The sound of the mountain stream at dawn penetrated his whole body, and Basui suddenly had a realization. At the sound of the stream at dawn. There's a Japanese poet by the name of Santoka who said, "In the never-ending sound of water, you will always find Buddha." Meaning, your own Buddha nature. It's right there. It's right there in that sound. That burbling of the brook. In our own creek here, in front of the retreat center. It's right there. And the sound of the geese, the crows. Sound of someone coughing in the zendo. Right there. Find our Buddha nature. After this experience of awakening, he went in search of a teacher to verify his understanding. He had heard of a well-known Zen master by the name of Kozan, and Kozan did confirm Basui's understanding. He was 31. Basui was 31 years old at the time. And then it was at this time that he started wearing Buddhist robes and began making pilgrimages around the country visiting Zen masters. Once he had seen into the emptiness of phenomena, including even the emptiness of robes, then he could relax and make peace with wearing Buddhist robes. Then he went to see a very famous Zen master by the name of Fukuan, who had studied in China. Fukuan had a following that numbered about 2,000. But Basui was unimpressed with him and returned to his hometown and went to see his friend Tokuke. He told Tokuke that he had not got on well with Fukuan and was planning to practice by himself in some isolated mountain retreat. Now Tokuke, having spent over 20 years practicing austerities and seclusion, had developed a great deal of pride in his practice. It's always a danger when you do something rigorous like that, is that the ego will appropriate that feat, that achievement for oneself. And apparently that's what had happened. Tokuke had become rather full of himself because of his austerities. He warned Basui of the dangers of this kind of secluded practice before fully understanding the great matter or receiving the transmission from a true teacher. There's a footnote here. Yeah, the footnote says, "It would seem from this statement that neither Basui nor Tokuke was satisfied with the verification Basui received from Kozan." So at that, Basui gave up the idea of secluding himself in the mountains and instead spent that year in a summer and winter training sesshin with Tokuke. It's like, I guess, a two-person sesshin. Tokuke told Basui of a certain Master Koho, who was considered a truly great teacher, and then Basui soon set out to meet this Koho. This Koho was a Dharma heir, was a sort of Dharma grandson to Mumon, Zen Master Mumon, who compiled the Mumon Kan. It says here, Koho was a strict teacher who greatly valued the precepts. I associate teachers who place great importance in upholding the precepts. I associate them more with Korean and Chinese teachers than with Japanese teachers. So this would have distinguished Koho. He did not confirm Basui's understanding right away, but asked him to stay a while at his temple. So Basui did stay, but he followed his custom of not residing on the temple grounds. He lived in a nearby hut and visited the master daily, for Doksan, presumably. One day during their meeting, Koho asked Basui why Joshu responded to the koan, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" with the one word, mu. And at that, Basui answered with a verse. Mountains, rivers, and the great earth, grass, trees, and the forests, all are mu. Well, this did not sit right with Koho, who scolded him for responding with his rational mind. And when he did, when he scolded Basui, Basui felt as though the foundation of his body and mind fell off, like the bottom falling off a barrel. And he then expressed his experience in the following verse. 6 windows naturally open, a cold lone flower. Koho strikes the rubbish from my eyes, crushes the gem in my hand right before me. So be it. This gold has become hard iron. Six windows naturally open. These are the 6 sense gates, the 5 ordinary senses plus the sense of thinking. 6 windows open. Koho strikes the rubbish from my eyes, crushes the gem in my hand right before me. Basui implying that he had been clutching at his understanding, his notion of having attained something, crushes that gem, and now gold has become hard iron. It is something that can function, something useful, something exceedingly hard and true. It's not just an embellishment, it's not just an accent, but it's now the real thing, iron. It continues, Basui's profound awakening pointed out to him how narrow his previous view of emptiness was. So Koho now verified his understanding and gave him the name Basui, meaning far above average. And Basui was 32 years old at the time. He spent 2 months at Koho's temple and then took to the road, seeking out Zen masters to engage in Dharma talk. He was asked to stay on to receive the Bodhisattva precepts, but Basui still had little fondness for the ceremony at the temple and decided to move on. His desire to seclude himself in a mountain retreat in order to deepen his understanding remained alive. It's around this time that Basui built his first hermitage. Tokuke was his first visitor, and that this time he seemed pleased with Basui's decision to retire to a hermitage to continue his practice. He seemed to be telling Basui that since he now had met both requirements, having clarified the way and having received verification from a true teacher, he was ready to undertake this kind of practice. Basui had a dream that his old teacher, Koho, was near death. He went to visit him at the temple he had founded and where he was now residing. And in fact, Koho was in poor condition, and so Basui wanted to stay on with him. But they ended up leaving for reasons uncertain, but the translator says, but perhaps related to strained relations with some long-standing disciples of the teacher. The older disciples may have resented Basui's decision to live off the temple grounds when he first practiced under Koho. And some were possibly jealous that Basui had received the transmission from Koho after such a short stay with him. All this resentment may have been compounded by the fact that Basui did not mix with the other monks and refused to take part in the formal temple activities. There's a saying in Mexico, Pueblo Chico, Infierno Grande, small town, big hell. And this is not the only account of monks becoming jealous, more senior monks becoming more jealous of more junior monks and their success. We know it became quite a feature of the story of the sixth patriarch, Wei Nung, where his teacher, the fifth patriarch, urged him to hit the road to avoid any kind of ill will on the part of the monks, because the sixth patriarch, too, was exceedingly young when he received transmission of the Dharma, 21 or 23 years old. And then Koho did die when he was in his 91st year, and Basui at that time was 35. And then Basui went to another well-known Zen master, Jakshitsu, who had been to China. It says Basui was attracted to the elegant simplicity of Jakshitsu's Zen. He talked about the meaning of monastic life and of Basui's practice before his formal ordination. Then Basui took it upon himself to talk to the monks at that temple. He told them that the meaning of monkhood was not to recite sutras, but rather to put their lives in order. It's a great phrase. We practice to put our lives in order. Basui always warned against the dangers of excessive formalization so prevalent in the great religious institutions of the time. In his own life, he preferred small hermitages over the large monasteries. This danger of excessive formalization is one that is as present now as ever, where form, etiquette, bowing, ceremony, too often becomes the main feature at Zen centers in this country, in Japan. And then Basui spent the next 17 years moving around the country, living in many hermitages. He never stayed more than 3 years in any one place, but still a following of following began to grow around him. When the numbers got too great, he even went so far as to leave a hermitage secretly and relocate somewhere else. It was not until his final years that he seemed ready to accept disciples in large numbers. At age 51, the number of disciples that gathered around him had increased to 800. Said because of the steep mountain path and the strong winds, Basui was encouraged to move to another hermitage where he remained the rest of his days. The year was 1380, and Basui was finally ready to accept the role of a teacher of a large institution. He refused the abbotship of two large monasteries and kept the final character an, at the end of Kogakuan, the final character an rather than jig, meant that it was just a hermitage. And then the number of students grew to over 1,000, monks and lay people. And it was here at this final temple that this text, Mud and Water, was recorded. It was published in 1386, a year before Basui's death, not at his request, but with his permission. So yet another Zen master who never published a book, but gave permission to his disciples to collect his talks and publish them. And this is interesting. In his final years, he developed great faith in the Bodhisattva Canon. In this text, Mud and Water, Basui referred to Canon as described in the Sharangama Sutra. And there's the quote. He was a person who, for every sound he heard, contemplated the mind of the hearer, realizing his own nature. So this is a valid practice in itself, is asking, who is hearing? With every sound, who is hearing? Or what is hearing? Basui had a shrine to Kanon built on the temple grounds and asked to be buried there. And then, at the age of 61, very young compared to other Zen masters, at the age of 61, he sat up in the Zazen posture, turned to his disciples and said, "Look directly. What is this? Look in this manner and you won't be fooled." He repeated this in a loud voice and died. And he was buried under the shrine of the Bodhisattva Kanon. Just before we finish, a couple of big aspects of Basui's teaching. He was very strict about not drinking alcohol. He left behind 33 rules of conduct for the monks as part of his dying instructions, and the very first of these was forbidding the drinking of alcohol. And then he once said, "The drinking of alcohol, of all broken precepts, is the most upsetting to the serenity of the mind." I have to think that one reason for how strict he was about this was that I'm told that the Japanese, American Indians, lack a certain enzyme that enables them to metabolize alcohol, so they very easily can become drunk. He also came to defend the copying of sutras, which and when he was younger he had no use for. But he said it's a practice enables one to empty the mind by copying sutras. We don't do any of that, and it's not part of orthodox Zen practice, but he recognized it as a form of expedient means that can help people in their own way empty the mind. Basui used stories based on myths and superstitions that were prevalent in medieval Japan. And then finally, about the title. No, let's leave that for tomorrow. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.